Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly. This is Insider's Capital. Every retiree gets one shot, one sequence of returns, one order in which the good years and the bad years arrive. And it turns out that that order, not your average return, not your asset allocation, not even your savings rate, is the single biggest determinant of whether your retirement plan survives. We've known this intuitively for decades. Bad returns early when the portfolio is largest and withdrawals are just starting cause a kind of permanent damage that good returns later simply cannot repair. Advisors call it sequence of returns risk. But even until now, few have actually done the deep background work on it to quantify it into a workable, actionable formula. Our guest has. He calls it the sequence tax, the exact calculable gap between what your portfolio earned and what you, the retiree, actually took home, and what he found after stress testing 123 retirement cohorts going all the way back to 1871 will change how you think about building, monitoring, and protecting retirement income portfolios. David Verratti is professor of personal finance and investments at the Schulich School of Business at York University, and he spent a career building quantitative frameworks for exactly the problems that keep advisors, and more importantly, their clients, up at night. So stick around. We'll be right back.
This is Insider's Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
David, welcome. It is terrific to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
To begin, David, please tell us about the arc of your career and the things you've been researching in that time. I think maybe if you can give us from the start of your career until now would be great.
That's quite a long arc, but just to summarize, I initially started my career as an advisor at RBC. And following that, I was very interested in quant, my experiences as an advisor, and a lot of the behavioral issues that come with being an advisor, trying to follow the market, trying to create some actionable rules for making decisions, led me to have an interest in quantitative methods. So I launched my career as a quant, as a research quant. I worked at Macquarie briefly as an associate, and I worked assisting with developing quantitative tactical programs for asset allocation. I spent a lot of time actually in consulting prior to that at CSSA, which was a blog that I started in 2009. That became fairly popular. I wrote about different types of ideas from trading to asset allocation to optimization. And I worked with a wide range of alternative asset managers, traditional asset managers, and also with traders. And subsequent to that, I went to Macquarie. After that, I went to Flexible Plan in the U.S., where I was VP overseeing research at ATAMP, the turnkey asset manager, overseeing thousands of advisors and taking a look at hundreds of different types of strategies. So it was an extremely valuable exercise. Following that, I went to Colorado and I worked as chief investment officer of a separate account manager, which was Blue Sky. And we launched an ETF issuer called Quantex, where I was the director of research. And so we created a suite of quantitative type funds that were directed towards decumulation. After that, I actually semi-retired for a while and spent a lot of time off, spent time with my son, who was very young at the time, and my family. I went into the food business and worked on some passion projects in COVID, much like a lot of people do. And more recently, I taught some guest lectures at the Schulich School of Business on personal finance and human capital and also investments. And so I was asked to teach some investment courses and some personal finance courses. And so I ended up teaching multiple courses, and that's where I am today.
It must be very gratifying to teach this subject at the university level, something that's almost completely absent from our elementary and high school curriculums.
You know what? It has been very gratifying. You know, I've enjoyed it a lot. It gives me a chance to connect with students and to be able to connect with their energy. They have lots of questions. And it's also great to revisit a lot of the curriculum and to be forced to come up with new ideas, revisit old ideas in light of what you knew. Having gone through a career and going back to academia and taking a look at the general curriculum and trying to merge what you've learned in the industry with the curriculum that you need to teach, it's fascinating. You have new ideas and then you realize where things in the industry, you've seen things in the industry that are no longer applicable within the curriculum and vice versa. You see things in the curriculum that the industry has overlooked. And so it's been forgotten about. So I think it's a great exercise.
And it's still so surprising to me that even in this day and age, we're not teaching our children about finance. And they often come out of university even without having any real knowledge of personal finance. And so, you know, this topic historically has been a blind spot for investors and even for people entering the business where you know, you learn about finance when you come into the business. We were surprised in the last year to find that by a substantial margin, the greatest advisor anxiety question that advisors tell us is surrounding decumulation, is surrounding retirement income strategies. It sounds like, to me, that was a topic that is thrown around a lot, but how do you get retirement income? And the surprising thing is that so many portfolios are still not built for it. Why do you think that is?
Here, I think it's a great observation. I think that the reason what makes decumulation so difficult is that there's so much uncertainty about along a variety of different dimensions. So an accumulation, which is becoming a little bit more complicated because of the instability of the workplace, but decumulation is extremely complex because you have liabilities that you need to fund. And you can't entirely cut these liabilities. Some of them, you know, involve your essential spending. You're no longer earning money in retirement. Presumably, you know, you're fully retired and you're living off of your financial capital. And so, you know, when you do conventional portfolio management with no liability matching, it's you know, a lot easier. Once you introduce liabilities, you have to consider how the portfolio interacts with those liabilities. Is it matched to those liabilities? Do we have a portfolio that, you know, can introduce sequence of returns risk? You also have longevity risk, which is how long am I going to live? And so you may live to the median age of, you know, early 80s, or you may live to, you know, 95, or you may, you know, we may have medical advances and people might live well beyond 100. So you know, these are real problems. And so all these uncertainties come together within decumulation, make it extremely complicated.
The sequence of returns question, most clients don't intuitively grasp sequence of returns risk until it's too late. So walk us through what actually happens to a portfolio when someone is withdrawing income and markets drop. And why is recovering from that so much harder than waiting out a bear market?
Okay, that's a great question. So sequence of returns risk, you know, if you're not withdrawing from a portfolio and I take a bunch of returns and I change the order of those returns, you're not going to have a different compound return. The compound return will be the exact same. But once you start to introduce taking money out of the portfolio, if you happen to have poor returns and you have poor returns early, then you actually have worse realized returns than the market. So if you say the market did 8% and you look over the last 10 years and then you look at your statement and you were in decumulation, you might look at your actual return, which is usually an internal rate of return, and that may say 4%. And you say, well, wait a second, what's happening here? You know, I thought that the markets had been up 8% over the last 10 years. And so the difference between that 8% and that 4% that you actually saw in your statement is what I call the sequence of returns tax. And that's the difference between what the market earned versus what you actually earned. That's your, you know, your personal rate of return. And how it happens is that, you know, if you have poor returns early in retirement and you don't have enough income from your dividends and the coupons from your bonds, for example, you're going to have to sell shares. and you're going to have to sell shares of equity when the market is down. And so if you had 100 shares of equity, for example, and you needed to sell some of them, now you have the market's down, maybe you only have 83 shares of equity. And so you're not going to replace those 17 shares of equity. And so when the market rebounds, you don't capture what someone does if they had 100 shares of equity. So if you see that, you know, the buy and hold investor, if the market recovers back to the previous highs, they'll be at parity. But you will have 83 shares, and so you will actually be below the previous highs. And so that's how it happens.
You're cannibalizing your portfolio in that situation.
That's right.
Right? So you have less. I mean, the common thing that you hear in this conversation space is, you know, if your portfolio goes down 50%, you have to make 100% in order to get it back to break even.
That's right.
And that's a very elusive idea for most people. They think, no, I just got to get back that 50% I lost. But if your base goes from $1 million to $500,000, to get from $500,000 back to $1 million, you have to make 100.
That's right.
But if you've sold $40,000 worth of that original $1 million base, then you're now at, you know, if you lose 50% of your, like, you know, it happens. It's not like it didn't happen recently. We've seen drawdowns like that in the financial crisis in 2008-09, where stocks were down in that range of, you know, in that range of correction. That kind of recovery happened, but not for those who sold their assets. I mean, there's so many issues involved here. Like, it's not just that you sell some assets in order to get your income. You're also running up against your own, you know, emotional behavioral risk. That, oh my God, my retirement assets are getting halved. And then you sell everything.
That's right.
That's the other risk, right? That's not even in our discussion here.
Yeah.
Our discussion assumes you continue to own what you own and you had to sell some of your assets in order to supplement your income. And now you have less assets as a base, you know, from a unit perspective, you have less units. So you, in fact, would have to recover a loss like 50%, you'd have to actually make in excess of 100%. It would be the 100% plus the portion you sold, whatever the equivalent.
You're going to have to make 110%. You would have to make a lot more. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because you deleverage your portfolio.
Now, that clarifies that. David, your work shows that the first 10 years of retirement explain 80% of the variance in lifetime sequence damage. And the first five-year window alone explains 53%. So that initial period is the most important period. If you look at portfolios today, they're not necessarily positioned for that.
So I think there's a lot of different levers that you have. I think if you happen to have the luxury of being a well-funded client, you know, perhaps you have a lot of liquidity. So if you have a lot of liquidity, you know, then the easiest way to deal with this problem is just to simply use your liquidity to finance the first, you know, 4 or 5 years of retirement and don't touch your portfolio. So that, you know, but that only applies to clients who are have the luxury of being overfunded. For most people, they're going to have to take, whether you're funded or whether you're underfunded, you're going to have to take a different approach. Now, if you're going to stick with, you know, conventional stocks and bonds, and you're not going to branch out at all to alternative asset classes or into things like annuities, then what you're going to have to do is you're going to either have to have the ability to cut withdrawals. That is extremely powerful. You know, having the ability to cut withdrawals if the market is down. That works very well in modeling in terms of, you know, improving survival. It's one of the easiest and best ways to reduce your risk. You know, another way is to cut your equity exposure when the market goes down, which is similar to, you know, to trend following. And so that does tend to work reasonably well, but it does create tracking error to the market. So, you know, you may underperform in a bull market if you use that approach. But if you use that approach within a short window of, say, 5 years, that it can potentially save you a lot, for example. So those are some of the things that you can do with stocks and bonds. Another thing you can do is you can spend from your bonds first. You can create some type of a bond ladder that's shorter term for the first 5 years. And you can use that to fund the first, you know, 5 years of your withdrawals. So a bond ladder, it could be a real bond ladder, it could be just a nominal bond ladder, or using GICs, you can actually fund, you know, the first 5 years, for example. But, you know, all these things come with trade-offs. So, and that's the unique aspect of decumulation. You know, some people, for example, propose holding a lot of bonds early in retirement. The problem with holding bonds early in retirement is it does help to preserve some of the, or protect you against some of the sequence risk. Not in the case if there's inflation issues, but, you know, if there's issues that don't relate directly to inflation, the bonds do help. And spending, you know, primarily from your bonds first can help. But the problem is that it introduces longevity risk. So if you hold too much in bonds, now you don't necessarily have a portfolio that can last for 30 years. So you have a series of trade-offs that you have to manage, even when you're just talking about the stock and bond space. And so from a lot of the modeling, you need to have more equity-heavy portfolios than you might imagine to be able to survive over a long period of time. I think the other thing that you can do is that you can dynamically manage your asset allocation based on your funding level. And based on how you're doing in relation to the return that you need to earn in retirement. And you can do that every year, and that also improves your survival considerably. So for example, if the market went down, you might increase your equity allocation. As you get deeper into retirement, you might increase your bond allocation. You get close to the end of retirement. There are a lot of different types of things that you can do if you take a little bit more of a dynamic approach.
If you can make it, so the key is to get past the first 5 to 10 years.
If you've gone through the first 5 to 10 years, then your probability of survival is very high.
The fixed income market presents a whole other challenge, and that's that we're in this period of higher for longer. And even that terminology, you know, even that ubiquitous term now gets used. Our sense is that there's not a full comprehension of what higher for longer actually means or what it entails. And so investors have yield options again, because interest rates have, you know, normalized is the term, right? We, you know, yields are finally back to somewhere between 3.5% and 5%, depending on where you look at the yield curve, which is both good and bad. So it sounds on the surface, superficially, it sounds like good news for retirees. But we've watched long duration bond holders get absolutely punished as, you know, as rates have climbed. And it's the climbing of those long-term yields that's been the biggest surprise. I mean, even following the inflationary spike that we had a few years ago, the Fed began cutting rates. The Bank of Canada began cutting rates. But those long-term yields have either remained high where they were, or they've gone higher. And, you know, we've recently even seen the 30-year treasury in the U.S. go above 5%, which was a big surprise. So, you know, we've turned the corner on 40 years of, you know, falling long-term yields. It's the bond market, you know, in your mind, David, is the bond market solving the income problem, or is it setting a new trap for advisors and investors reaching for yield?
I think you made a lot of great points. And I think just going back to the beginning, just it helps to frame everything. And I think the best way to frame everything is that a stock and bond portfolio is incomplete. And so when I answered you in terms of sequence of returns risk, and how to deal with that. I was dealing only in stock and bond space.
Right.
You need to introduce other strategies, other assets, and other solutions to be able to have a complete decumulation portfolio. Stocks and bonds are really designed for growth and deflation. So if we think of a four-box matrix where economic growth is rising or falling and inflation is rising or falling, and those two are interacting, so we have a four-box matrix. You know, equities tend to do well when, you know, growth is rising and inflation is falling, and especially tech stocks. And bonds tend to do well in deflation, which is when growth is falling and inflation is falling. But whenever there's inflation, whether growth is rising or falling, that's where we have a problem. And so equities tend to muddle along. As long as growth is rising, equities tend to do okay, but they still suffer. And when growth is falling and inflation is rising, which is stagflation, bond and equity portfolios get crushed. And so that's like a 2022. And so those are the situations where you realize that you have an incomplete portfolio. And so when you talk about the last 40 years, a lot of people have a failure to study market history that goes well beyond that. And having studied a lot of cohorts between 1871 to present, some of the worst cohorts occurred when inflation was higher. And so your sequence of returns risk was the highest when it was paired with inflation. And so if you do not have a portfolio with inflationary assets at the minimum, at the simplest level, then you're going to struggle. So you're not going to be able to address a 2022. And it shouldn't be surprising. And so what we see is that the low correlation between stocks and bonds is an artifact of the growth dimension. You know, rising, falling. And so, and bonds, you know, had the tailwinds that you were describing where interest rates were really high and falling. And so they had the price appreciation in addition to their yield,
right,
you know, which heavily bolstered portfolios. And obviously they don't have that same tailwind today, although yields are starting to get a lot higher. So these are some of the primary issues that you need to consider. And so the correlation when inflation is rising tends to rise between stocks and bonds, which means that they become poor diversifiers. And so that's why we need to introduce inflationary or real assets to be able to complement that. And we also need to have assets that can perform well in a wide variety of different regimes. So in a sense, float around in that four box matrix, if we use a simplification. We need, you know, something like managed futures can perform well because it can do well in three of the boxes of that four box matrix. It doesn't happen to do well when growth is rising and inflation is falling, but it can perform well and provide some convexity in those other areas.
And there's also there's a host of other asset alternative assets that do well in some of those four boxes as well. Right. I think that the nut to crack, you know, like today, a lot of fixed income allocations have shifted to shorter duration, ultra short HISA accounts, you know, high interest savings accounts, money market, wherever investors can find both yield and safety. The problem with that is that while they do provide, some of these options do provide very decent yields that mirror yields of the past, they don't offer any convexity or any price appreciation the way bonds once did when long-term yields were falling and you got that price appreciation, that capital gains right. bump that surfaced when stock markets were correcting. You know, money would flow risk off into the bond market and you would get falling yields during those periods that gave you some price appreciation in the bonds that offset some of those losses in the stocks. But as we saw in 2022, to your point, that was really a wake-up call, because when inflation is 2.5% or 3% or higher, as it was then, or maintains at the 2.5% to 3% threshold like it has been since, then we get that problem of correlations rising between stocks and bonds. So really the real solution is to allocate to assets that have no correlation or in some cases negative correlation, You mentioned managed futures, trend following. How else might advisors consider replacing part of the traditional fixed income sleeve with something that provides not only positive expected return, but some convexity that more effectively dampens the market volatility that long-term bonds once offered?
I think your question has a lot of good points, and I think there's no perfect or hidden asset that can can offset all of the different risks. And I think from a deflation standpoint, if we go back to the matrix, I think from a deflationary standpoint, long-term treasuries, putting potential credit risk issues aside, or currency issues aside, if that's stable, that is the best deflationary hedge. So if we're going to assign things to each bucket, it may not have the highest yield, but at 5%, it's a very competitive yield. Things that fall in the same bucket would be like, utilities have a bit of that element. They're long duration, but they're more like almost like real return bonds in the sense that their payouts can rise with inflation. So they have that longer duration sensitivity to an extent, and they have the interest rate exposure. But they also have the ability to, have rising dividends over time. So they tend to fall a little bit in that bucket. If you want to offset that bucket because you don't want to be fully tilted towards having deflationary assets and having an imbalanced portfolio, what I found is that the assets that best hedge long-term bonds are energy. The energy sector best hedges long-term bonds. It can't fully hedge long-term bonds because at a certain point, rates, as duration climbs, you have a lot of interest rate risk that can't be hedged, but still some of the best assets to be able to reduce the volatility of long-term bonds are things like energy equities, commodities, and things like that. So
right.
Those tend to perform well when long-term bonds are performing poorly. So if you want to enhance the yield of deflationary assets, you can add in things like utilities. And if you want to offset them, you want to lean more towards commodities and energy.
And frankly, David, utilities have become very exciting again. When you look at what is going on in the electricity market relative to AI, data center demand, the fundamentals are shaping up very strongly. So the timing is quite opportunistic in that space. What about in the real assets categories like infrastructure?
Yeah, for sure. If we talk about the inflationary space, there's if you want to gain income, you have the pipelines are excellent. You have your Enbridge, TransCanada pipeline, Pembina pipeline. A lot of those types of companies that have monopolies and have cash flows that rise with inflation, and they have, inflation sensitivity to differing degrees. Pembina is definitely a good one with respect to that. So those things can help provide you with that inflation. They also have contractual ability to, raise their rates with respect to inflation as well. So, that's a great situation where you have positive exposure to the break-even rate or changes in the break-even rate or inflation expectations, and you have the ability to raise your cash flows along with inflation. And so those assets tend to do well with that. Infrastructure is also useful, although it doesn't have quite as much beta to that, but it does tend to do extremely well. You have these, toll roads, bridges. They also have the ability to raise the rates in line with inflation. So a lot of those assets are excellent.
And given each category, like we touched on managed futures, where would you fund an allocation to commodity trading advisors as a heading? Where would you fund that from? Would you fund it from the equity sleeve, or would you fund it from the fixed income sleeves?
I think that's a great question. And I think that question, first I'm going to answer that question. I think the first thing I want to talk about is where I see the role of managed futures, and then talk about, I guess, the funding aspect of things, which I think is incredibly underappreciated. I think with managed futures, you view it as almost like a utility player. It can basically perform well in a wide variety of environments. So as I said, three of the four environments,
right.
The Goldilocks environment is not the best environment for managed futures. That tends to favor technology. But in all the other environments, managed futures can provide you with convexity. So they provide you with the ability to have a large and increased exposure to whatever is performing well because they tend to follow trends. So they're not going to have a high delta. So they're not going to have immediate sensitivity to what's happening with trends, and they will tend to lag, and they will tend to underperform when things are going sideways. But when there is a large trend, they will have convexity to those trends and how they develop. And so they're definitely a portion of the portfolio along with the real assets, the bonds, and the stocks. And so managed futures just kind of allows you to, your portfolio to be more adaptive, as opposed to having to statically determine, what the future composition of market regimes is going to look like. In terms of your funding question, that's a great one. So if you're a regularly funded client, or even worse, if you're an underfunded client, and what I mean by that is that, when you're into accumulation, you have to fight a lot of different things at the same time. You need to be able to address sequence of returns risk. You need to be able to address longevity risk. You need to be able to address inflation risk. You need to be able to address liquidity risk. And every asset and every product has pros and cons along those different dimensions. And none of them exactly addresses all of those problems simultaneously, which is the big problem. So if you're underfunded, then you need to be able to do multiple things at the same time. So every dollar that you take and you put it towards, say you're trying to address sequence of returns risk, maybe you're going to be leaving longevity risk unaddressed, or maybe you're going to be leaving inflation risk a little bit higher. So you need to be very capital efficient when you're underfunded. When you're overfunded, you actually can allocate your portfolio to all those different areas as you see fit. And you don't even need to worry about many of those areas because you can address them with much simpler mechanisms. So, and when you're regularly funded, you still need to optimize a lot to make sure that you're going to continue to remain on track over time. So one of the best ways to, if you're underfunded or funded, is you do need some degree of capital efficiency. And so you need to have things that are, portable alpha type funds. You may wish to even use small percentages of, believe it or not, leveraged index funds that are 2x leverage, for example. All of these things can free up capital.
Right.
And when you free up that capital, you can use that spare liquidity to offset sequence risk by, for example, if you carve out 20 or 30% of your portfolio and you spend 80 cents to create a dollar of exposure. Now you can take that 20% and allocate it towards, the first 5 years or the first 6 years of payments. Or you can take, even better, you can take that 20% or whatever slice that is, and now you can apply it to, for example, annuities, or you can apply it to managed futures, or you can free up capital so you're doing two things at once. And so it's similar to a baseball team that doesn't have enough money to be able to buy all the different positions. If you can get a hitter that can also pitch for the same price, then that's a great deal. So then you can actually start to form a complete team. And that's the problem that you're in when you're underfunded.
Yeah. And it's interesting, that you definitely, there's a lot of interesting options today for introducing capital efficiency very inexpensively to a portfolio, like at minimal cost, by exploiting, different kinds of ETFs that provide that solution, and to free up the capital to do other to make allocations to other assets without sacrificing your core, your beta exposures in your portfolio. And it brings up an interesting point about, the misunderstanding that in most investors still have about the 60-40 portfolio x-ray. Like if you x-ray a 60-40 portfolio, the traditional foundational 60-40 portfolio, what you actually end up seeing is that because the bonds, the 40% in bonds contribute so little to diversification, the portfolio looks more like 90% equity risk instead. Yeah. And theoretically, capital efficiency would say your portfolio, if you want to balance between the fixed income, the traditional fixed income and the traditional equity or traditional assets in a portfolio, it looks more like 90-60, right? So,
yeah,
right? So you would actually need to use capital efficiency, which is what institutions are doing, to boost their exposure to a diversity of assets, so that the risk is equally balanced across the different assets. And this now we're getting into risk budgeting. But the bottom line is that, you know, a lot of investors are looking at their growth needs or their liability funding and thinking and making the mistake often of increasing their equity exposure in order to do that.
Okay. So I think
it's a real risk, right? You've got a lot of investors using, for example, you could misuse, like 2x ETFs, for example, like a 2x S&P 500, for example. You could misuse it as a speculative exposure.
Sure, and believe it or not, I think that you can use some of those ETFs in small percentages, as contrary to popular belief. You know, there is volatility drag, but you know, believe it or not, you can, if you pair it, for example, a 2x index ETF with an index fund and you pair it with T-bills, you can very closely track the market. But what you've done now is you've freed up liquidity. So
that's the important part. That's the portable alpha part.
That's right. And so you can do that. And I think that option is incredibly valuable. So speculating is, you know, that's not the topic I think that it, you know, I would wish to discuss, but I think.
I brought it up. I brought it up because yeah. I think there are a number of solutions in the marketplace today that
yeah.
you could use speculatively if that was your tilt.
Sure.
But that's, you know, the danger, I think, is that a lot of investors are looking at their liability funding and thinking, you know, I need to make more money. I need to increase my risk. But
right.
but really what they need to increase is the breadth of their portfolio.
Yes.
Right? The breadth of diversity in their portfolio. They need to increase, like, for example, you know, you mentioned energy equities, like some of the integrateds like Enbridge, Pembina, you mentioned those two. So that's an equity allocation shift,
right?
Which provides diversification within the equity sleeve. When it comes to investing in, for example, infrastructure, where would you allocate from? Like infrastructure assets are different from equity, pure equity assets. Would you allocate from the equity sleeve to infrastructure, or would you allocate from the fixed income sleeve? What is the traditional fixed income sleeve to infrastructure?
So all great questions. I think you need to find some kind of a balance. I mean, it comes down to what you're talking about, which is with respect to 60-40 and carrying imbalanced risk exposure. But, you know, risk parity will restore the risk exposure between stocks and bonds so that they're more balanced. But, of course, there'll be short inflation. And so, obviously, as you're mentioning, we need to have some inflation in there to balance things out. And so, you need to also figure out how to balance appropriately, you know, without getting into quantitative solutions specifically. But you know, just notionally, you're going to want to have an allocation to inflation sensitive assets, you know, and you're going to probably want to carve that out of your equity simply because your equity is already quite high. And so, you know, you can fully restore your bond exposure if you want, you know, to balance everything. But, you know, I look at things more in liability space. And now that I look, I'm taking the retirement lens. When you're in decumulation, you need to think a little bit more in liability space as opposed to purely balancing the fluctuations, you know, of the portfolio. So that is more of a risk tolerance, behavioral, extremely important. And you want your portfolio to be consistent, but you also need to consider, you know, having an potentially imperfect balance between all of those in order to make sure that your portfolio will be able to last long enough in retirement.
So is that more looking at what role each asset play in the portfolio? Okay.
That's right. Because, you know, if we look at the four major factors, you have sequence risk, you have longevity risk, you have inflation risk, and you have liquidity risk. Nothing perfectly addresses all of those things. You know, a typical retiree, as opposed to one that's overfunded, has essential spending that they need to make. And so the core issue is first, how do we best address that essential spending? And so, you know, I like to call that the floor, and in pension space, it's typically called the floor. And, you know, usually when you're funding the floor, you're going to look at CPP and OAS. Those are going to help fund the floor. You want to defer CPP and OAS. And, you know, that gives you a really high rate of return and increases the amount of money that you can make on that floor. Then you want to look at things like, you know, whether it's workplace pensions, you want to look at annuities. A lot of these things help to build that floor so that you don't have to worry about essential expenses and have to withdraw from your risk assets. Right. So I think that's, you know, that first approach, you know, and we also talked about using bond ladders. You know, addressing those essential expenses is the first goal or decumulation retirement planning, because the safer that you can make the floor spending, the less sequence of returns risk you have. So even if you don't buy an annuity, if you fully matched all of your payments, you had enough money, and you fully matched all of your payments with real return bonds, for example, you wouldn't have any liability risk. So if I took a zero coupon bond that matured at every single year, right, based on the amount of money that you need in retirement, you know, if you needed $40,000 a year, inflation adjusted, I buy a zero coupon real return bond for every year in retirement. We don't have to worry about sequence of returns risk. Anything in excess of that, we can put in equities. We can do whatever we want. So, you know, if you had an annuity, for example, that paired with CPP and OAS, covered those essential expenses, then it, you know, all these things change the way that you look at your final portfolio. So the percentage of your essential spending that is covered by some very safe floor, you know, dictates your portfolio management.
Excellent. And one thing I found really interesting in your work was, you call inflation a hidden withdrawal. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Inflation is a hidden withdrawal. Well, it's basically going to, if you increase your payments in accordance with inflation, you're going to be drawing more money out of your account. So right, traditionally, you know, if you have drawing $40,000 a year, if you're drawing it fixed, then you're not really worrying about inflation as much. But when you're increasing the amount that you withdraw from your portfolio in accordance with CPI, then you are going to be increasing, you know, how much you draw from the account. So if you're, you know, the price of everything goes up 10% and you have $40,000, now you're withdrawing $44,000. So that $4,000 is an extra withdrawal or tax on your account. So
it's something that people don't traditionally think about. You know, that's
yeah.
If you just maintain a level payment, then you would be short that $4,000.
That's right.
Right.
That's
so
right.
You would have to cut your living standard according to that. So that's another. I mean, that's another way of considering it as a tax. You have less. Obviously, you have less disposable. Your income has less purchasing power. That's the standard view of inflation. But even if you were just maintaining a 4% withdrawal against your assets and not accounting for CPI, your standard of living would go down by that amount every year.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. I mean, if you have high inflation, I mean, by the time you get to year 9 or year 10, if you maintain a level payment, your $40,000 buys half as much. So, you know, I think you need to consider that. You know, I think with withdrawal rules, what you're bringing up brings up that, you know, we talk a lot about asset allocation and portfolios, and it's incredibly important to address that. But your withdrawal rules are extremely important. So how you manage your withdrawals and your ability to have variable withdrawals, as in being able to cut withdrawals and also being able to change the way that you apply and smooth how inflation adjusts your payments over time is extremely important as well. And these things are, you know, often what determine retirement success and failure, independent of what's in your portfolio.
Now, on the longevity question, at the end of the day, I mean, the whole purpose of creating a retirement strategy, a retirement income plan for a client, the job is to make the portfolio outlive the client, ideally by a substantial margin. That's probably more likely with an overfunded client, but for an underfunded client, it's equally important that they leave assets behind in most cases. And so what's the, if you were sitting in front of an advisor, what's the framework you would put in front of them today for building a decumulation strategy that could hold up across a 25 or 30 year retirement through multiple rate cycles, any kind of regime change, bear markets, whatever comes next?
I think the first thing that I would address is the floor. So do we have enough to be able to pay for your essential expenses? Now, when you look at someone who's underfunded, oftentimes, you know, when we talk about funding, there is a single rate of return that dictates what you need to earn to be able to make certain payments in retirement. And we can figure out what that is mathematically. Once we figure out what that rate of return is, you know, for example, if you want to withdraw $40,000 a year, then we can compare that to what you can earn. And in most cases, an underfunded client doesn't have the ability to earn that rate of return unless they go up the risk spectrum to risky assets like equities. And so if you let the optimizer loose, what you're going to see is that for underfunded clients, they're going to have 90% equities or even potentially 100% equities, because that's the only feasible solution for them.
Right.
So for the underfunded client, capital efficiency is the only way that they can effectively address everything, in my opinion. So you must figure out ways to buy $2 worth of exposure for a dollar or something like that, so that you can be able to have multiple products to address all the different issues. So 100% equity, while it may, you know, maximize your probability of your retirement being feasible, is a pure gamble, right? If you use a capital efficient portfolio with the underfunded client, now they can go ahead and buy an annuity. They can go ahead and buy managed futures exposure in addition to their bonds, or managed futures exposure in addition to their equities. They can do a variety of different things to be able to create that diversified portfolio that they require. You know, now they also have dollars that they can apply towards real assets and towards, you know, higher income real assets. You know, we talked about pipelines. We talk about the distribution transmission like Enbridge, a lot of these different types of things. And so once you create that capital efficiency, you can now allocate your portfolio and diversify while still being able to meet your specific needs. You know, when you're talking about a funded client, I think, you know, the key is with a funded client is that you want to be able to deliver the floor to them as efficiently as possible. And so the floor is, you know, if it's fully liquid, for example, would be real return bonds plus, you know, Social Security or, you know, CPP and OAS. That would form the basis, or, you know, could be a short-term bond ladder. These would form that you would continuously roll. Those would form the basis for their floor expenses, which is how much they need to, you know, pay towards rent or pay towards utilities or property taxes or, you know, mortgage payments or food, you know, those types of essential expenses. So if you don't have the ability to fund that with bonds, because it's very expensive to fund that with bonds, then you can look at things like annuities. And so annuities are a practical solution to help to fund the floor. But the problem with annuities is that they lack liquidity. So they take away from the liquidity dimension. They reduce the sequence of returns risk, and they improve your longevity risk, or they reduce your longevity risk because the payments continue well beyond your expected. You know, so if you happen to outlive expectations, the annuity will continue to provide you with floor income, and same with the CPP and OAS. So that is the first. It's a kind of a more of a priority sequence that you look at, I think. And so once you've done that, you can also use things like tontines, which have a little bit more variable payments. They have the benefit of being more liquid. They give you more exposure to things like mortality credits, you know, but they're a, you know, pooled vehicle. And so if everyone tends to live a lot longer, then the payouts will be affected accordingly. And also you do have fluctuation. It's like a managed payout fund that has mortality credits. So that's essentially what a tontine is like. And you have some liquidity. So it can outperform annuities and has, you know, a different set of benefits and disadvantages. And I think both of them are very useful. And so when you look at your floor, all these things are great assets for the floor. They address your sequence of returns risk, and they address your longevity risk at the same time, which are really the two big ones, because you can always cut down on your discretionary spending. So if I say, well, I need $50,000 to cover all of my essential payments,
right?
But of course, I want to take vacations and things like that. Well, you can always cut that in a bad year. And having the ability to cut that is a tremendous option. And so it effectively increases, it's almost like accumulating, it increases your leverage. You know, when you don't withdraw when the market's down, you know, you're increasing your exposure to the market, which is exactly what you want, right? So,
right.
So I think your portfolio should be dedicated, if possible, when you're funded, you know, towards dealing with non-discretionary payments and also whatever legacy or bequest that you want to be able to offer. And I think if you're overfunded, you know, then I think it becomes a lot more of a behavioral problem. You want to create a portfolio that is going to improve the client's overall experience and make their money efficient and work for them as well as possible to meeting all their needs and, you know, making it very tax efficient and dealing with those types of issues.
Couple of points, David. I think, first of all, I think something novel and exciting that you brought up is the capital efficiency or the use of capital efficiency as part of a strategy. I correct me if I'm wrong, but if you are, let's say you're 20% underfunded, you could then theoretically find the tools, the ETFs, for example, out there that would provide you with the capital efficiency and create a bump in your overall asset base using that capital efficiency, right? And then you're putting more assets to work or having options to invest in other assets that provide more yield or more growth, more combination of growth and yield. Like even just thinking, you know, without getting into specifically into capital efficiency, even you've got In some cases, you've got like lightly levered covered call ETFs that provide some capital efficiency. Like, so you start with $100 and you get 1.25x, right? And then the income that's generated is coming from either from the 1.25x or coming from the additional 25% increase in assets. That gives you a measure of higher income from that $100 base that's worth 125, that notional value of 125 versus 100. Or you use capital efficiency to free up capital. And you mentioned tontines. We did a great episode with your colleague, Professor Milevsky, on that very subject, on tontines. Very interesting. Another very interesting solution, alternative to annuities, that's out there. There's annuities, obviously, but I got a little bit excited in while listening to you, because I thought, you know, for someone who is underfunded, there are very interesting investment options out in the marketplace today that weren't there 5 years ago, frankly, that are available today that actually do provide that capital efficiency built in at an extremely low cost of borrowing because of the way that they're structured. So you can see where because, you know, the carrying cost within these very efficient, capital efficient structures is so low relative to the yield that you're seeking, that if you could get a 4% yield or a 5% yield or better using that capital efficiency, that outpaces the cost of the capital efficiency by a substantial margin. So that's a really interesting, like you could theoretically structure a portfolio for somebody who their 100% of assets is not enough to sustain their income needs, but maybe 125 or 130% over 100, maybe 130 over 100 or 150 over 100 would find them in a better situation. Maybe not 150, but let's say you added capital efficiency of 20 or 30% in addition to their base. You could do some exciting things within that space.
For sure. And they each have a set of different trade-offs. You know, for example, if you, you know, if you do capital efficiency with, you know, with a covered call that has a bit of leverage, you know, there's some, you know, tax benefits and practical advantages of getting that income, but essentially you're short convexity. And so it's, you just have a more constrained distribution of outcomes. And so it can function well, it has its place. And for example, if you buy a leverage fund and you pair it with the index and you pair it with T-bills, you know, in equal proportions, then you can, you know, create a near index replicant that can have some positive convexity. So it can outperform on the upside. So, you know, you can mix and match a lot of different things. If you get a portable alpha strategy, you might be able to mix two different asset classes in at the same time, or general exposure at the same time. So a lot of these different types of things, and there are probably a lot more that I haven't mentioned or haven't even thought of, but I think all these things can free up liquidity, restore funding. And I think the best situation is where instead of the underfunded client having to be, you know, and this in and of itself is something highly overlooked by advisors, and I don't think most people even think about it. What is your required rate of return to sustain retirement? I don't know if every advisor necessarily calculates that. And then the feasibility question, which will of course put you 100% in equities. Once you use the capital efficiency, now you can diversify. You don't have to be 100%. And I think that that's super important, because now your distribution of retirement outcomes are much better. You know, if you were able to free up capital to buy an annuity, now your floor is higher, you know? So, you know, that already reduces your sequence of returns, risk and longevity risk all at once. So, you know, or you have the ability to bolt on things like managed futures when you previously didn't have the room in your portfolio for that. And that helps to offset the risk that comes from owning stocks and bonds. So, you know, you talked about the long-term treasury. You can hold a long-term treasury in favor of the intermediate treasury. And that in and of itself can reduce the capital exposure to bonds. So a lot of different things. And all these things have trade-offs. Nothing is free per se, but you can create a better set of trade-offs overall.
Right. Where you're balancing between your need for income, your need for growth, and longevity, all three, but in a more efficient, more optimal way. I think
that's right.
I mean, I got excited because I never thought about, I've thought about capital efficiency from, you know, the construction view, the portfolio construction angle, but never actually considered it from the underfunded, overfunded position, which is the liability space that you're talking about. Like if somebody is underfunded and there's an opportunity for them to equalize their funding using, you know, level their funding using capital efficiency, that in itself is very exciting. I think, I mean, I hope that's something that a lot of advisors will take away from this conversation, which is that you can fairly easily solve the common underfunding levels using capital efficiency optimally. And obviously, you know, there's homework involved. You gotta learn about these things with a little more depth. But the tools are out there. The tools are available. It's just a matter of doing the investigative work to discover which tools are going to solve the problems the best. With time, also, you know, the tools will get better and better as well.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think every advisor should be calculating the retirement required rate of return for their clients, which is the rate that they need to be able to meet their basic lifestyle needs plus a certain amount. And so that determines your general funding status, and you need to know that. And I think from an investment policy standpoint, and from a risk tolerance standpoint, there's always this tension. Well, this person is conservative, you know, but then you look at their funding level. I think a lot of people say, well, there's a huge mismatch.
Yeah.
So the client says that they're conservative, but, you know, without creating that required rate of return and determining their funding status, now you say, well, I'm just going to go ahead and go with, you know, the client's risk tolerance. Well, now you're guaranteeing that they will not be safe in retirement. So they will be comfortable,
yeah,
but they won't necessarily have a safe retirement.
Well, and that's where you're going to have, you know, the debate between logic and emotion.
That's right. Right.
Where the client is like, well, I don't know if I'm prepared to take more risk than I am right now, or to be less conservative than I am. Right. So that's probably a longer conversation that all advisors have with their clients anyway. But
they need to be able to point to that number and say, you know, by the way, if you don't do this, then you're almost guaranteed to fail. So
there's a sweet spot between the
Sweet spot. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I think that's the key tension, and that's where you need to optimize. You need to be able to have the minimum risk portfolio that meets their retirement required rate of return. You know, so and not think in terms of standard deviation. You think in terms of shortfall.
Yeah.
So you don't you shortfall risk. You want to reduce the downside risk below that. So if you can think of that ratio, you know, that is a great ratio. And I've been working on doing some research in that area. That is where you want to be in terms of maximizing your retirement survival.
Yeah. And you've got a formula that you have actually are near publishing. And David, this has been a terrific conversation. I think it's probably the first of several, I hope. it would be great to have you back to talk about capital efficiency in greater depth, and go a little deeper on you know what we concluded on, because I think that's a very exciting topic to delve into, which is how, from your perspective, from the personal finance perspective, from the perspective of, you know, underfunded clients, because I suspect that there's quite a few. There's a lot of underfunded clients out there, and there's a lot of underfunded clients for whom advisors would like to help solve that problem in a way that is going to balance more effectively between those dimensions that we talked about.
Yeah, I think it's a very important problem. And I think it's something that you know can be improved by looking at these dimensions.
David, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight.
Oh, thanks a lot. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.